nothing you have done has put you in the lead that you have right now. Man, I tell you what, that's a powerful statement right there. We're going to wade into the deep today, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a moment. But first, how many of us, if we're honest, we're a little uncomfortable as we're watching that? I mean, you're like, whoa, that's good. I'm glad. It makes me uncomfortable every time I see it. And one of the things that typically happens is as you listen to the eight qualifiers that he mentioned, we kind of play along in our head, right? We're like, well, where would I be? And so I want to just have a moment of sobriety right now, if you want to participate. How many of us, you know, as you were hearing those qualifiers said, yeah, I wouldn't have taken any steps forward, maybe two steps forward, or I was just at the back. I mean, I've really had all of those things mentioned. I have not had any of those in my life. Anybody want to say, yeah, that's me? I mean, I would have started at the back of that race. All right, how many of us would have said, thank you for that, for your honesty? How many of you would have said, yeah, I'd be in the middle. I mean, I certainly didn't, you know, all of them didn't apply to my life, but definitely some of them did. So I would have been in the middle of that field, middle of the pack of students. How many of you, yeah, okay, awesome. How many of us would have said, man, and we're willing enough, courageous enough to say, I'd be at the front. I mean, I pretty much assented to all of those have been true in my life. How many of us, yeah, thank you for your courageousness. That's me. I mean, I would have been in the front minus maybe one. See, the question I want us to wrestle with today is, what lead do you have? What lead did I get that had nothing to do with what I've done? I mean, this is an equity conversation. And, you know, regardless of how hard I've worked, regardless of how much resolve or how much, you know, effort I put in or perseverance I've had, but simply because of conditions outside of myself, things that have impacted where I am that had nothing to do with decisions that I've made. And so we're going to wrestle through that because, you know, the reality is, like they said in the video, there's no excuse. I mean, we all have to run the race. We all have to run the same race. They have to run the race, and those that are in the back, those in the front, those in the middle, we all have the same race to run. But the bigger question is, I want to help us discover today, you know, a bigger picture understanding about the human race and the reality that we do not all start at the same place in this race called life. So that's what we're going to look at today. Great to see you here this morning, Crosspoint. Really excited you came back after week one of the series. And if you're new here today and we haven't met, my name's Kurt. It's great to have you here. We're in week number two of a series called Unmasked, Revealing God's Heart for the Human Race. And we've just felt this growing burden, you know, just with kind of the culture going on all around us in our country, even in our community here, this rising race tension, exhibits of hatred toward people not like us, and it just burdens us. And so we're just trying to say, how do we gain a deeper understanding of God's heart for all of humanity? And so as your pastor, as your spiritual coach, I'm just kind of helping us explore some realities over these 3 weeks that we've got to wrestle with in terms of God's kind of his view and his love for the human race and how he wants us to reflect that. And so whether you're here every week or, you know, been here a few weeks or you're brand new today, I'm just glad you're here. This is a really, really important conversation. And as I said, today we're going to be wading into the deep. And specifically into the world of privilege. And for many of us, this is what's allowed us to get to where we are here today. In fact, all of us in this room, let me just be honest, let me just include us all, we're all privileged by being in this room today. I mean, you're privileged by being here, meaning you had a car to drive here, most of you. And even if you had to walk, you're not dealing with things like ageism or ableism that's preventing you from being able to get out and do things. So, I mean, in some way, shape, or form, we're all privileged, but we've got to evaluate, where am I in this bigger, you know, spectrum of privilege in our world? And so a couple things today, because we're going to really look at how our faith and what Jesus calls us to and what his life was about intersects our responsibility in this picture. And so today, we're going to put our big boy pants on, and what I mean by that is not that if you disagree with something I say or share or show, which you likely will, and I'm guaranteed there's going to be some pushback, that if you disagree that you have little boy pants on or you're wearing pull-ups. I'm not saying that. It just means that if, you know, we're going to have to, like, kind of really dig deep and have some moments of sobriety and deal with some things that we don't always like to wrestle with. All right, so that's what I mean by big boy points. Also, there's going to be a few moments where, you know, you may experience a range of emotions, and that's okay. And so there may be a moment, one of them might be anger. It's okay if you feel anger at some point. The only thing I ask you to do is to dig into why something bothers you. What's the thing behind the thing you may not be aware of that's really causing you to feel a bit angry? You know, whether you're white, black, Latino, Asian, Muslim, Jewish, those are just some of the ethnicities here. We all may experience different levels of this. If you're white, You may feel a little bit of shame or guilt. I just want to say that's not for you. That is not from God. Shame is not something that God desires for us. That's from this intelligent darkness that's at work in the world. And so I just want you to know, if you feel any guilt or shame, that certainly isn't at all something that is from God. Another emotion might be fear. Sometimes when we dive into things, you know, we're just like, I don't know that I want to have to be faced with this reality. And once I kind of consider, I'm now responsible. Don't be afraid of having this conversation. It's not normal in church, but this isn't just a safe place. It's a brave place. And then fourth, I want to ask you to listen with courage today. It takes courage to wrestle through weighty topics. And I was just like, man, why couldn't we have done a fun series going into the journey? That would have been a lot easier for me. And my team was like, well, because we don't do that. We tackle the more difficult, weightier things. So I just want you to be in a posture of grace today, not only on this topic, but for me. I mean, I certainly am not addressing everything I'd like to share on this. In fact, there's going to be holes, and I'm just going to ask for your grace on that. And yet, I just pray that we have ears of love. Not only, you know, as I share, but for each other as we listen. And I just believe that as we do this, God's going to do something powerful and unique in us, but he's also going to do something powerful and unique potentially through us. So last week we looked at Jesus and the greatest commandment, where Jesus was asked one day, hey, what's the most important thing? And Jesus said, that's easy. I can sum it up in, you know, in basically 3 or 4 seconds. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And the guy asked him the question, said, that's it? And he said, yep, that's it. You know, it's like the ultimate Cliff Notes version of the Bible right there. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your neighbor as yourself. And so this phrase, love your neighbor as yourself, it's repeated over and over in the scriptures, in fact, 8 times in the New Testament. In fact, you may know it as the golden rule. And so it's something that Jesus even repeats over and over. In fact, in another episode, he actually mentions this as one of the demarcations or the marking or the identifier points of what it means for people who are following him. In fact, another one of the authorized biographers of Jesus' life, John, who wrote what he saw about Jesus' life, the Apostle John, he wrote this, and this is Jesus saying this, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. But this is new. You're like, well, you said that last week. Well, this is a new version of this. He says that you love one another just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. And we go, whoa, whoa, whoa. Last time you said this, it was love each other the way you want to be loved. Now, Jesus is saying, yeah, I want to up the ante on this a bit. I want you to love other people the way I have loved you. And then he goes on. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have this kind of love for one another. And then the Apostle Paul, who's writing later in the New Testament, he kind of shows how Jesus exemplified this kind of posture for us. And it leads us to the word we're going to look at today, Philippians chapter 2:7. Paul writes, he, meaning Jesus, gave up his divine, and here's our word right here, privileges. Meaning there were certain privileges that Jesus had being the Son of God. There's certain privileges that Jesus chose to give up. He forewent them. He could have easily stayed in heaven at the right hand of God, and yet he gave everything in heaven up in order to do something else for you and I. It says, yet he took on the humble position of a slave or a servant and was born as a human being. And so Paul's like, Jesus actually models this for you. He shows you what he wants you to do for others. Paul recognizes, hey, this is God. He can do whatever he wants to do. I mean, Jesus easily could have stayed in heaven. He never had to come down here, but he gave up his privilege in order that others might come to take some steps forward, because he realized that there's a responsibility that comes with privilege. And so if we want to really love people deeply, we have to really understand people deeply, and we have to understand the gap that's there between their life and our life and the opportunity that they have and the opportunity that I have, and what's my responsibility in that? I grew up in white middle-class America. I never really thought about privilege, never thought about white privilege, which is something I want to talk about today. I wasn't even on my radar. I assumed everybody grew up like me, lived in a neighborhood like me, a house like me, lights were always on, food always on the table, never felt like I was, you know, in danger, rode my bike 2 or 3 miles from home as a 4th, 5th, 6th grader. It was just safe. I just assumed everybody, you know, had this experience. I thought, you know, this whole idea of racism and the injustices and equity issues in our world, that doesn't exist. That was resolved way back, you know, in the 1960s, until my sophomore year of college. Sophomore year of college, I went on a trip. We started doing some spring breaking with some of our friends, and we went down south to the Carolinas, six, seven of our friends, myself, and one of my friends with us was black, and I'll never forget, we stopped for dinner, and once we got into the Carolinas, the reason we went to the Carolinas was because it was like south enough to be warm, but we were cheap college students, and yet it was north enough that the hotels were like dirt cheap, and we could afford them, so that's where we went, you know, for spring break. And so we'd get down to the Carolinas, and my one friend, you know, we'd get out to go eat, and all of a sudden, it's almost like he became a different person. Like he interacted differently with us, you know, would almost like follow us, sometimes wouldn't really engage a whole lot. And I remember just saying, what's wrong? Like, what's going on? No, nothing. Fine. Okay. You know, we'd eat and we'd go on and travel a little further, get out, you know, somewhere else, take a break. And again, it was like the demeanor was just different. And again, I'd be like, dude, you okay? And, you know, did somebody say something that offended you or like anything going on? No. And he never really say much on it. And then it made one comment, I'm like, oh my gosh, are you thinking that this is like a rate, like because you're down here that you have to act differently because like we're in the South and you can't be yourself? And the answer is generally yes. I'm like, oh, that's crazy. I remember thinking, that's stupid. Like, there's no racism going on in our country anymore. That's all in your head. Like, that's just made up in your mind. Later that night, we got to our hotel. We were checking into our hotel in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And I had made the arrangement, so I was in checking in the group, and my friend, who was black, was with me, and he asked a question of the lady checking us in, who was white, and she answered me instead of him. He asked the question, and she'd look at me and answer me. And I thought, well, that's a little odd. And then he asked another question, and again, she was focused only on me, would not look at him, and gave me the answer. And I'm like, well, he's standing right here, and all of a sudden it hit me, oh my gosh. Like, she won't even look at him. Like, this is real. Like all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I realized that simply because of the color of my skin, someone was paying attention to me and not my friend. And it totally rocked my world. And for the first time, I felt this sense that I'm being given bias on something. Like, somebody's actually elevating me in a sense and pushing my friend down. It was my very first moment I ever in my life realized this whole idea of white privilege. Peggy McIntosh, in her short essay, White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, she talks about how we each carry a knapsack around. But she says, for white people, that knapsack has all kinds of resources, guides, maps, blank checks, all kinds of helpful tools that allow people who are white to get significantly ahead than other people. And everybody has a knapsack of every race, but there aren't as many tools or opportunities available in each knapsack. Tim Wise, who is kind of this kind of face of kind of the anti-racism movement, he's a white guy, he's an author, he wrote the book Dear White America, you may have heard of it or read it, White Like Me, says this. He says, it's not about saying that all white people are rich or all white people are powerful, they're not. The way people need to think about it, that we don't, is that privilege is just the flip side of oppression or discrimination. So if you think about American history with years and years of enslavement and years of segregation, this is a part of American history that I think we all agree is real, right? I mean, I think we'd all agree on that. So we've had hundreds and hundreds of years of oppression, which I think we all would agree is accurate and is very real. And so he says, what's the flip side of oppression? Well, the flip side of oppression is if some people are down, by definition, that has to mean some people are up. All right, so if we think about this, for hundreds of years, there was an elevation of whites by this system that allowed this to happen, which meant there was a pushing down of browns and blacks. And somehow we think, I mean, it's absurd to think that just signing a couple laws into place 50, 60 years ago is somehow going to stop all of the inertia of hundreds of years of this system getting further and further apart, where whites have accumulated more and more advantage and blacks and browns have accumulated more and more disadvantage. It's going on for centuries. We think a law is just going to bring that to a halt. I saw a documentary last week. You guys may have seen this fantastic documentary. In fact, I highly recommend it. It's called Hello Privilege, It's Me, Chelsea. It just came out like a week ago Friday night. It's a Netflix original. Chelsea Handler, comedian. It's very funny, very real. But she's basically asking the question, how can I be a better white person in this whole race conversation? Which I think that's a very good question. That's a question I've been asking. How can I be a better white person? And one of the things she discovers is that she's exploring white privilege and how it's built into the fabric of our culture and how she herself has actually benefited from it as a comedian. So take a look at this scene here.
Welcome. We're really glad that you could join a company of word workers. I consider comedians writers extremely incisive writers, and the best ones are all from Lenny Bruce through Richard Pryor through many others, are able to, through comedy, and help us critically self-reflect. We're all here to talk about privilege, not to point fingers, but this is not a safe space. This is a brave space for that.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, sorry. Should I sit over here? I want to make sure you guys, do I need to stand? I feel like that's presentational.
Whatever you want.
You can sit down with us. You can sit there.
All right. I'll stand first and then I'll sit. Thank you for having me here tonight. My name's Chelsea Handler. Thank you. And I am as white as they come. And I'm interested in this subject matter. I'm filming a documentary, as you may or may not know, about white privilege, because I grew up never thinking about being white because I really had nothing else to compare it to. And it wasn't until I really got comfortable in my own life that I was able to look around and go, something off here. And so I don't want to keep talking because I've made a living out of talking. And I'm really eager to have a conversation about what it is I can know more about and to illuminate to people who are not of color what it means to be of color in this country.
We are disenfranchised racially and on a socioeconomic level. It's great to talk about it because you need to start somewhere. But where is the action gonna start? I appreciate you being here. I appreciate anyone that's trying to reach out and gain a deeper understanding of where we are and where we need to go. But this rabbit hole goes deep, deeper than a documentary.
One of the things I've noticed in conversations on white privilege is that it always ends up being about people of color's experience. It comes to here, and it stays here, and it never becomes about whiteness. And I think that's one of the things when you ask, what can I or what can the we that is collectively identifying as white do? You do need to learn about others, but you also have to learn about yourself.
Your privilege is that your voice is always gonna be heard. You wrote a book called You Gone to Be Kidding Me. And like, honest to God, I don't like the title, but like you got to do it. Like you got to do whatever you want. And like, I just want y'all to know that there is a different game that we have to play. And there is a different situation in which our voices and our perspectives get limited.
Feel free to edit this out, but cause I'm like really embarrassed to be here with you because this is just another example of white privilege, using your white privilege. And what are you gonna do with it other than come into this space and take?
As a lawyer and talking to a lot of lawyers in this room, we actually do believe conversation matters, language matters, discourse matters, dialogue matters, because you can move the needle with the right kind of hard work and painful, uncomfortable conversations like we're having now.
Well, that was intense. They were like, what is this gonna do? What is your documentary gonna do? What is it? That's great that you wanna make a documentary. Basically, like, it's a privilege for you to make a documentary, which it is. I mean, I liked the pushback. I like having difficult conversations, so it felt good because they put me in my place. But I also got the impression that Black people are sick and tired of being asked questions about white people's problems. We need to talk to people who are white and stop asking Black people to solve our problems because it's a white person's problem.
I love the one comment about how we do need to continue to learn about others, but we've also got to learn about ourselves. Which is really what I'm asking us to do today. I want you to learn about yourself. Okay, where am I at this in this spectrum? Because see, here's the thing. If you're white, it's easy to think, and maybe you've even said some of these things. Well, I mean, there's not much of a race problem in our world. I mean, you know, didn't that go away like, you know, 50, 60 years ago when we signed laws into place? I mean, they need to step up. I mean, they need to take responsibility. They need to find a job, work harder. Or maybe we've even argued that we're not a product of white privilege. I mean, I'm not where I am because of white privilege. I mean, nobody handed my job to me. Nobody, you know, gave me my education. I mean, I worked my ass off to get where I am. Nobody created this for me. I created my life for ourselves, which all of that may be true. All that may be true. But here's the thing. Considering that white, I may be a product of white privilege, it doesn't take away from the fact that I've worked hard and I've you know, put energy and effort and busted my tail. It doesn't take any of that effort or commitment away. I mean, you may have worked as hard, I may have worked as hard as the next guy or gal. But see, we can't ignore the reality that simply because of the color of your skin, you start at a different place on the playing field of life. We can't ignore it. Statistics just continue to show over and over and over. And I know you worked hard. I worked hard. But back to the analogy of the race. I mean, when you think about a field, being white, I mean, let's shift to football. Being white is like getting the football on the other team's 20-yard line every single time. Every single time. And so we're going to score nearly every single time. There may be times, I mean, and of course, if you're the Colts and you have Adam Vinatieri, I mean, it's up for question right now, right? I mean, but we're going to work that out today. I'm pretty confident. But nonetheless, it's like starting on the 20-yard line. I mean, all my white friends, honestly, my life's been starting on the 20-yard line in life. I mean, honestly, Crosspoint probably wouldn't be here if I was a different race. I'm going to be honest with you. Crosspoint's here because of my privilege. That's the realities I've been coming to. All my black friends, brown friends, they're starting on the 20-yard line at the other end of the field. Right? They got 80 yards to go. Do they score sometimes? Yeah, they score sometimes. But it's much harder. They got a lot more ground to travel on. See, data and statistics continue to show us that there are systematic ways built into our fabric of our culture that push some down and continue to push others up and widen the disparity. In fact, we can think about a number of systems. Let's look at the housing system for just a moment. I mean, the way that we continue to see kind of segregation in the housing system. Let me show you a dot map of Indianapolis, northeast Indianapolis area. I know it's kind of hard to make out, but you see where Crosspoint is up there. The blue dots are white, where white people live. The green dots are where black people live. The red dots are Asian. The yellow are Hispanic. Now, you can't see the contrast, but around Crosspoint, actually Hispanic, Asian, black, and white all are in that area, but it's predominantly white. But notice the segregation that immediately happens. There's like a street where all of a sudden it goes from white to black immediately. And we are still a very segregated greater Indianapolis area. And one of the reasons for this is because of what's called white flight. See, when African Americans move into a predominantly white neighborhood, white people don't always want that. And so when that gets to about a 10% move-in rate, white people begin what's called white flight. And when whites leave a neighborhood, it lowers the value of that neighborhood. The demand goes down for that neighborhood. And so that property, which was once a good investment, is no longer a good investment. It's now actually a loss. There's a research project done called the Milwaukee Housing Project a number of years ago, from 1971 to 1993. They looked at a number of different scenarios, factors. And one of the things that they were focusing on is the disparity in housing between whites and blacks, and just being in the right neighborhood, how it actually sets you significant house. One black family, in fact, in the study, one of the things they did, among others, is they tracked two families that each bought a house. One black family, one white family, each bought a house that was $40,000 in value when they bought the house. And then they tracked that over the 22 years, and by the time they got to the end of the study, guess how much that white family's house was worth? Take a look at this, $250,000. So they made over $200,000 over 22 years simply by living in the right neighborhood. The black family, on the other hand, after experiencing white flight 22 years later, that house was valued at $32,000. It actually went down, yet 22 years later. See, this is what's created by white flight. In fact, the Milwaukee Journal talked about this. It said from 1970 to 1990, the white population in Milwaukee declined by a third, falling from more than 600,000 to just under 400,000. The number of white residents fell by more than 90%. Many moved to the suburbs. Many African-American workers who had only recently purchased their homes saw them fall in value below what they owed on the mortgage loans. The homes were not building equity, which might be used for home improvements, repairs, getting through a difficult time, helping the kids through college, and the owners couldn't afford to sell them. This is all too common a story of what happens in neighborhoods on the housing front, specifically with minorities. I mean, there are systematic forces that are at work pushing some up simply because of where you have the ability to live and what the color of your skin is, and pushing others down. And you might push back on this, and you might get a little defensive, be like, well, I worked to get where I am. I worked to get to live where I live. You did. You did, absolutely. It doesn't take away from that. I made upgrades to my house. Great. You probably did. They may have too. But you can't ignore the disparity. There's no way around that based on where you live. I mean, if you live in the blue, which, you know, many of us do on this map, you can't get around that. There's a privilege that comes with that. There's an enormous head start for all races. For all races. Black, white, Asian, Hispanic. I mean, Julie and I, we sold our house that we moved into when we moved to Fishers 13 years ago. We moved into Fishers. We sold it a year ago. And when we sold that house for 53% increase in price over what we bought it for. I mean, that talk about a head start, that gives us an enormous head start for where we move next. I mean, there's no way around that. Part of the reality is me realizing how privileged I have been. Simply because of the neighborhood, the opportunities I have, the ability to get a loan, the income that we have that allows us to buy a home like this. See, what I want us to see, man, these things help us move down the field beyond what other people are able to move down the field on. Jesus, he once talked about his housing situation. He talked about this in Matthew 8. He said, foxes have dens to live in, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to even lay his head. I mean, Jesus, one of the things he realized is he had every opportunity to advance his privilege. When you own a home, regardless of your race, it's privilege. You're privileged, all right? But the level of privilege varies based on where you own, all right? Where you live establishes your privilege. What Jesus is saying here is, I don't want to be tied down to that. I came to actually, you know, help those who aren't experiencing the privilege. He said, I'm not going to claim the privilege. Now, he's not saying don't buy a house. He's not saying don't own a house. Probably most of us own a house. It's just recognizing that there is certain privilege that has allowed us, because of nothing we've done for ourselves, to get into wherever we are and be even to able to live in the right neighborhood. I mean, it's sobering, honestly. It's very sobering. Let's consider another system with an overwhelming disparity, the criminal justice system. William Stoltz, in his book, The Collapse of the American Criminal Justice, he references drug use in America. He says there's about a 10% drug use among black the black community. There's a 9% drug use among the white community, 8% drug use among the Latino community. And so when you look at those numbers, it'd be logical to think, well, the conviction rate among, you know, people who are arrested for, you know, possession of drugs would be pretty equal, right? I mean, in light of the fact that these are 1 or 2 percentage points away based on use. No, not at all. Get this, the conviction rate for blacks versus whites. Blacks go to prison 9 times more than whites for the exact same crimes. Let me say it another way. Blacks go to prison 900% more than whites for the same crime, and Latinos somewhere in the middle. And it's not just the going to prison part. That sucks, right? That's like a major life interruption. Your life's on hold. The bigger thing is what happens when you get out of prison. When you get out of prison, you can't get a loan. You can't, you know, vote. You can't get public housing. You can't get a student loan. You have difficulty landing a job. Who's going to hire a felon? And you come out of prison, and you're the pariah of society. You're like a second-class citizen. Now, what's fascinating about this, Jesus, think about Jesus for a moment. Jesus didn't make these you know, criminals second-half citizens. I mean, Jesus, you know, Jesus gave his privilege up for people who were criminals. That's the very thing he did, which includes you and I. He gave his life up for everyone, but specifically criminals. Think about when Jesus was nailed to the cross. They put nails on him on the cross, and they hung him, not for anything he had done for himself, but he was taking on the sins of the world. But on his right and on his left were 2 criminals who actually deserved to be there. One of the criminals actually taunted Jesus. Remember this little scene? They, you know, the one calls out and he's like, Jesus, if you're really who you say you are, if you're really the Messiah, I mean, take yourself off this cross if you have that kind of power. And the other criminal looked at Jesus and said, or looked at the criminal and said, no, he's the one that doesn't deserve to be here. We're the ones that deserve to be here. Jesus easily could have hung his head and disregarded either one of them. The one criminal says to him, Jesus, will you remember me later today? And you remember what Jesus says to him? He turns to him and he says, I assure you today you will be with me in paradise. Jesus didn't see him as a second-class criminal. He gave him just as much upward mobility as anyone else. See, Jesus chose downward mobility in order that others might have a shot, just a shot at upward mobility. New York Times bestselling author Robin DiAngelo, she talks about the systematic power structure among whites in our world and the white privilege that creates in her book, White Fragility. And in fact, I want to show you a few of these statistics because they're just sobering. 10 richest Americans, 100% white. U.S. Congress, 90% white, which, by the way, America's about 50% white, 50% all other races. U.S. governors, 96% white. Top U.S. military advisors, 100% white. U.S. House Freedom Caucus, 99% white. Current U.S. presidential cabinet, 91% white. People who decide which TV shows we see, 93% white. People who decide which books we read, 90% white. People who decide which music is produced, 95% white. People who direct the top 100 grossing films of all time worldwide, like top world's movie producers, 95% white. Teachers, 82% white. Full-time college professors, 84% white. Professional football team owners, 97% white. Who holds all the power? Who holds and sets the power structures? Tim Wise, again, in speaking of this whole idea of white privilege, he says, it's the white person's problem that has consequences for people of color. It becomes a problem for black and brown folk because we don't deal with it. And if we would deal with it, it would not be a problem. But you can't solve a problem that you can't name or even recognize that is real. There's a lot of sobering stuff here. And if you don't hear anything else, I want you to hear this right here. If you are white, listen, you have privilege. Whether you agree with that or not, you have privilege. And that's not something to feel guilty about, but that's something to be leveraged for other people's advantage. That's the posture Jesus always took. How can I use my privilege to gain advantage for others? I mean, if you're white, listen, it's not changing. I'm white. It's not changing. I can tan. I mean, I'm white. I am white. That is not changing. But it's not okay out of my whiteness to turn my head away from issues that I know that are there, as opposed to bringing my energy and the purposes of my life toward helping others have an upward mobility. I want to give us one more picture on this. Because, see, here's the thing. I mean, if I'm honest, everything I've mentioned today, all the excuses I've mentioned, all the statements you may have thought this or that, those all have come from me at some point in my life. I mean, I'm just taking things out of my life that I've said. I've grown on this over the years. It wasn't until that moment in college that I even realized I was privileged, right? But when you see somebody that you love and appreciate begin to be treated differently than you, I mean, this isn't a news feed. This isn't something I read on a social feed. This is like somebody I love and care about, and all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, this is not right. And it changes you. And it changes your view of how the power structures in the world. And my question is, okay, God, what's my role in all of this? So one more picture from the Apostle John. He gives us this walkout that's really fascinating in 1 John chapter 3. He says this. He says, if we are rich, which let me pause on that for just a moment. How many of you would say you're rich, just out of curiosity, so I can get a read of the room? How many of you say you're rich? Okay. That's what I thought. All right, so if your kids come home and they're like, well, Mom and Dad, are we rich? Are we rich? You know, how do you answer that? Probably go, well, I mean, we do pretty good. I mean, we're not rich, right? That's probably how it goes. Well, here's the deal. If you live in Hamilton County median household income is $90,582. That's the median household income. MarketWatch.com says interesting thing. They say if people who make $90,000 generally believe they are not rich. But then they report this statistic. They say people who make $90,000 a year actually earn more than 87% of the U.S. population. I would call that rich, all right? I'm going to let you decide for yourself. So if we are rich, which I'm going to say is you and I, and see others in need, kind of like we talked about the Good Samaritan last weekend. So if we see others in need and yet close their hearts against them, meaning we ignore their reality, we push them down instead of lift them up, we discount instead of empower, or just discount that racism and the equity issue in our world isn't really a problem, then he asks this question. He says, how can you claim that we love God? Which is right back to the thing that Jesus was talking about. He said, what's the most important thing? Love the Lord your God with all your heart. Love your neighbor as yourself. What he's asking is, how can we claim to love God if we claim to acknowledge and see the actual needs of people around us? And then he continues. He says, my children, it's like a father. He says, my children, so it's like a father just trying to help his kids, you know, kind of understand something here. My children, our love should not be just words and talk. Why? Because that's cheap and easy. It must be true love that shows itself in action. Well, what's that look like? Well, love in action looks like compassion. It looks like gentleness. It looks like humility. It looks like understanding. It looks like activism. Love in action. Active love is activism. It's actively taking a role to address this in the places of my life that I can. It's caring enough about someone else's upward and downward mobility as opposed to just mine. And remembering that our Savior, he chose downward mobility just so that others could have a shot at upward mobility. I saw a great picture of this week in the sports world. Right, with did you guys see the story on University of Virginia coach Tony Bennett? He won the national championship last year. The president of the university comes with like a ginormous new contract for him, huge raise. I don't know what it was. Maybe they reported, I didn't see the number. But he and his wife declined it. They said, basically, we have enough. We don't need any more. Thank you. That's very generous, but we're gonna keep on the contract. I've got a great contract. I'm just going to keep up on the one I'm on. And then he went on to say, because if I take that contract, it's everybody else in the athletic department's going to pay. I want everybody else to have some upward mobility, not just me. I'm like, whoa, that is a picture of equity right there where everyone wins. Everyone wins. See, we all win when we recognize that me getting more, me getting elevated, if it costs someone else some downward mobility, that's not a win. I love how Carol Anderson talks about this again in the Netflix documentary. Take a look at this scene.
Black people feel what an unequal, oppressive system has done to their communities. They feel it viscerally. They feel it every day. They feel it when they're going down the street and a cop pulls in behind them. They feel it when they walk into a store. They feel it when they're looking at an unequal paycheck. And so this is part of the work that white people have to do, frankly. White people have to have the conversation with white people about what the actual history is, about what the actual consequences are. And so those are hard conversations, because what you're doing is you're reordering a history of a people. You're reordering personal histories. That is like striking at the core of someone's identity. Mm-hmm. And that is where the backlash is. That is where the defensive mechanism is.
It's like black people want to talk about it, but white people don't want to talk about it.
Well, part of the problem is that...
It's like talking about porn at the dinner table. You know, yeah. I mean, obviously at my dinner table, that would be fine, but no one's coming to my dinner table anyway. I'm solo.
Lord have mercy.
So white people, listen, I'm talking to white people in the room. White people, we have to talk about this. This is why we're talking about it today. So thank you for being here. Now, I want to broaden the conversation a bit for our last segment here. I want to invite our pastor, who is black, of student ministry and pastoral care here. Help me welcome to the platform, Dr. Mark Johnson this morning. Come on up here, Mark. Now, interesting enough, I did say Dr. Mark, because you are a doctor, right?
I am.
Is a doctor. He's got his doctorate.
Earned doctorate degree, I do.
Yeah. So, Mark, our team just went up and through the roof when you joined our team. Why did you want to join Team Crosspoint? Like, just talk about that a little bit. You talked last week, but some of these people didn't hear it.
They didn't. Well, let me take it a step further. I mean, even before joining Crosspoint, I mean, even coming to Indiana, I mean, I reflect back on the clip you showed about race, that race and where you started on the playing field. And one of the reasons why my wife and I, why Whitney and I even accepted a position to come to Indiana, was because we saw that the school system was better, that crime was lower. Coming from Baltimore City, having an opportunity to get further on that field, we looked at Indiana as a place to do that. And then when we came here, we landed in Fishers. Mm-hmm. And so to be in Fishers, that even put us in our minds, you know, creating a new family, being in a position to set our children up. To not be as far back on that playing field played a huge role. And then beyond that, I mean, Whitney and I, we started attending here on Thursday nights. And when we came in, we experienced a welcoming and warming environment. And we weren't necessarily looking for anything, but when we walked through the doors, we found so much more. We found a community and a culture of people who we didn't feel like they was like, oh my God, there are black people here. Let's all rush them, right? But it was more of an environment that was like, hey, we see you as people. And that was really important to us. Yeah. So, I mean, the culture here was one. The content was two. The content was good. I mean, what we're doing right here, having courageous conversation about difficult subject matters and not just scratching the surface, but being willing to have a conversation about privilege. I mean, that's content that matters. Mm-hmm. And then finally, Kurt. I mean, I think because, I mean, whether you like it or not, or whether you even receive this type of praise, having a culture like that, having an environment like this, says a lot about the leadership, says a lot about you. And you to be willing to have this type of conversation also speaks volumes to the type of person that you are and where you're growing on this subject matter.
Awesome. Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about presence and proximity, because that's a big piece of how we continue to break down the walls on this.
Yeah.
So talk about this a little bit from what you see.
Yeah. Well, presence and proximity has been something that's really vital when you talk about privilege or race in general. Let's just take, for instance, these amazing, would you like?
I will tell you, this has already been skimmed off, like it's going down.
Well,
my kids eat them over there?
Yeah, there you go. Maggie and Matt, they were nibbling on them. So if you take this, and there was an experiment done, and if I took this vase of M&Ms and I put it in on my desk, right, I'm more likely to engage these wonderful peanut chocolate M&Ms, right? Mm-hmm. But if I took this, keep on, I mean, it's good. But if I took this same group of M&Ms, it's all, we got more, there we go. But if I took this same group of M&Ms and I sat it in the lobby, I'd be less likely to engage it. If I took it and put it in the parking lot, I'd be less likely to engage it. It's all about presence and proximity. Mm-hmm. And for me, unless we get in each other's presence and get in each other's proximity, we will never be able to understand what it means to be in another person's shoes. Mm-hmm. And having that presence, and it's different just being in proximity, right? Mm-hmm. We can be in proximity, but that doesn't mean that you're present. Right. And presence is about being incarnated in a person's life, mm-hmm. sitting at a dinner table, going to, you know, public events with them, you know, sharing moments with children. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what really creates presence and proximity.
I know for me, I've grown on this over the years, and I've have a number of friends that are Black, of other ethnicities, and we can say, well, I have friends, but it's more the depth of relationship,
yes.
It's being a part of the holidays, it's being a part of real life and those significant times that really caused me to just see differently.
Yeah.
And to see, and really it's more about seeing myself differently as mm-hmm. much as it is about us, me and yeah. him or her. You recently were a part of a round table, like your first week here, you got pulled into a round table because of our leadership connection, and
yeah.
With 25 white pastors, 25 Black pastors, we spent 24 hours together. Talk a little bit about the learnings and discoveries out of that.
Yeah, it was a lot of learning, but this was a very unique setting. I kind of got thrown into this conference, but it was an amazing opportunity, and it wasn't just a conference about a conversation about just race or religion. It was really an opportunity to be in the presence and proximity of people who have just had different experiences. But what made this unique was that we also had to room together with somebody of a different race. Now, that is where the learning took place. One, because the rooms, if you didn't know, you walked into the room, you saw one bed. I said, well, they're really pushing the envelope on this. We can have conversation, but I don't know about cuddling too, right? But, you know, luckily they had the sofa was actually a pullout bed.
Gotcha.
But if you didn't do the
Did everybody know that?
No.
No.
Everybody didn't. So there are some pastors out here that slept with each other. But it was a good learning experience. I had an opportunity to room with a guy named Josh Wagner.
We know Josh. You guys know Josh, United City Church pastor. Yeah.
And so Josh is a cool dude. And I mean, we learned so much about each other. I mean, we got a chance after the conversation. That just put us in each other's presence. In proximity. But the rooming aspect gave us presence. And we talked about hair products and, you know, how did he get his hair swooped over on the top and what he used.
We just wake up this way.
Yeah, you wake up like that. It looks pretty good.
Yeah, right.
But I had to explain to him, like, what a do-rag was, right? Because he's like, well, what is that thing I see, you know, Black guys wearing? He's like, I'm like, well, look, first of all, we're not trying to rob a bank, right? Just because you have a do-rag on, it doesn't mean that. But the reason why we wear this silk tied around is so that we can get waves in our hair. Right, he's like, oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was style. I thought it was fashion. I'm saying, no, it was about trying to create a certain type of look. So, I mean, those are the type of conversations that you can only get if you're in the presence and proximity of other people. So.
Presence and proximity is huge, 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 huge. Yep. Yeah. Hey, let's thank Mark for joining me up here, Sharon. It's great to have you here, Mark. He's going to stay up here with me as we wrap up. There is so much more we could. I mean, we're scratching the surface on this, and we don't really have time now, unless you want to be here through the Colts game, to go further. But I hope that we're seeing, my prayer is that we're seeing that we can't truly love others until we understand really our privilege. And then how does that impact others? And what's my role and responsibility? I mean, that's what it took for me. Because being white is not going to change for me, but I have a role in this. And so I have to use my privilege. And it's not a one-time conversation. It's not a one-time, you know, it's advocating in all spaces of our lives, in the workspaces, in the school spaces, the recreation spaces, the coaching spaces, the friendship spaces, the neighborhood spaces. As John says, not closing our hearts to the realities, but being love in action. And I don't know what that means for you. I'm going to trust God's going to help make it clear what that means for you. But I tell you what, if we can begin to have that sense and awareness of, my gosh, I have a role to play in this as we go to work and as we coach kids and as we live in our neighborhoods, I can guarantee you the temperature and the climate of our community continues to get healthier. And so I want to give us a couple next steps. If you want to take out your connection cards, just a few walkouts before we wrap up. On the back of your connection card, and these are really for you to just say, okay, what am I doing as a response to today? First, I just want to encourage you to return next weekend. I think it's cool that you're here today, especially if you're here last weekend or you knew we were talking about this ongoing conversation about race and racism. It's a conversation we have to be a part of, but I hope you'll return next weekend. We're going to be talking about identity next weekend and this identity that we receive when we become followers of Jesus that supersedes anything here on the worldly identities we pick up, which is a really big unifier in terms of how we, the church, actually operate as the human race, the way God wants it to be modeled in the world. So I hope you'll come back next weekend. Secondly, I want to encourage you to watch this documentary, Hello, Privilege, It's Me, Chelsea. It's on Netflix, if you have the Netflix app, 65 minutes. It was just released last Friday night. Didn't even know that. I saw Chelsea on Seth Meyers this week. She was talking about it. I'm going to warn you, she keeps it real, and it's very, very uncomfortable, especially if you're white. But I encourage everybody to watch it. The language is rough. That doesn't bother me. I have rough language sometimes. I made my three older kids watch it. Older two watched it. Third one was, you know, in and out some. Because I hope you don't get hung up on the language and that you're able to grasp the meta-narrative of this bigger conversation. Of somebody just asking the honest question, how can I be a better white person? Next step, I want to ask us to be intentional this week on presence and proximity. What does that look like for you? How do you begin to dig into some relationships deeper, go beyond the surface, begin to be a part of the deeper part of people's lives who are not like you? I know for me, that's what's began to change me, and I'm still growing. I'm still growing in this. Participate in family gatherings together, holidays, significant life moments, crisis moments. The second day here, you had one of these
second
crisis
day,
moments.
Man, it was amazing. Yeah. I got an opportunity to be in a member's household. It just had a tragic moment. And then a few weeks after that moment, I got a chance to be in presence and proximity of that family. And then my family came to visit me, and we were out in the commons, and the lady whose family I was a part of in that moment came around, and she put her arms around me and told my mom, this guy was a rock for me. And in that tragic moment, I was able to be some, it wasn't about race, it wasn't about color, it was about being present. And so it matters.
Last, get into a small group. It's one of the places. I know you're hearing us champion small groups. This is where we model what it looks like to get along. This is where we model understanding each other. I don't know that all of our groups are going to have diversity. I hope they all do. But this is where we model people that aren't like us, people that don't always have the same values as us. We model for the world what it means. It's why one of my beliefs and why God created the church. And the best place that gets exhibited is in the small group environment. So get into a group today. Man, this has been awesome. Thank you, Mark. A lot to digest today. I hope you'll come back next week as we wrap up with week number three, part three of Unmasked. Mark, will you pray for us, and we're going to sing one more song. Pray for us.
God, we thank you for giving us an opportunity to dialogue and to communicate and to really hear your heart on this matter. God, help us to unmask all of the things that have pushed people down and may have even elevated us in our privilege. Father, I ask that you forgive us if we've not leveraged our privilege to help those who are underprivileged today. And God, just give us the grace and the strength and the peace to know that we can be a part of the solution and no longer be silent about the problem. God, we thank you for this moment. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Hey, let's stand. We're gonna sing one more song. It's a brand new one, but this ties into what we've been talking about, so Ashley will teach it to us here.